one of those fun sticking points in theology, which is actually somewhat divisive still between different denominations, is what actually happens in communion. And the problem with the answer is that there are layers to it. On the one hand, it's a memorial of the night when Jesus actually took bread and wine and said, "Do this in remembrance of me." And again, it's a thanksgiving for all that Jesus was and is for us. And yet, it's something more, because when we take bread and wine, we say the words of institution, and we gather around the altar, the bread and the wine are no longer just bread and wine. They are changed, which is why we don't take the wine that has been consecrated on the altar and pour it back into the bottle it came from, or take the bread out to coffee hour and use it as our post-church treat. It's actually a horror story somewhere of a new pastor who did that. Fortunately, his church was understanding. For us, communion is all of these things. For other churches, it's one of these things, and for some people, it's even more than any one of these things. And the trouble is, and this is important, so pay attention, the trouble is, at the end of the day, we don't really understand. Words fail us. Something important happens on that table with the bread and the wine and the words we say, and we don't fully understand. In fact, these two disciples on the road to Emmaus may have come as close as anyone ever has to putting words to what happens. In the breaking of the bread, they recognized the Lord. Which is pretty good, given that they weren't doing so well up to that point in the story. Cleopas and his friend, who never gets a name, and I feel kind of sorry for this friend, have left Jerusalem. And that, to be fair to them, is sort of the smart thing to do. I give them credit for staying until the third day. They've hung on to the last shred of hope they had. But when the women, those crazy women, came back from the tomb with this insane story, and remember, it was an insane story, they gave up and they left town. You have to imagine them walking away from Jerusalem, away from their last hope, telling the best stories of the last years with Jesus. And then this stranger joins them, this stranger whom the narrator kindly clues us in is in fact the risen Jesus. This stranger who is oddly out of the loop on everything that has happened recently. So, being good sharers of information, they fill him in. And then he starts teaching them. Now, Jesus didn't have an IQ test for his disciples, we already know. But these guys are clearly not doing well at this point in time in the story. And as evening comes and they begin to make plans to stay somewhere for the night to eat dinner, this stranger makes as if to keep going. Apparently, he has a long journey that day. And they prevail upon the stranger to stay and eat with them and spend the night. Instead of letting the stranger keep going and being alone, the two of them with their stories and their memories and their grief. And that night at the table, as has happened before, the stranger takes bread, blesses it, breaks it, and they know with whom they are sharing a meal. They have experienced communion, the same communion we still share. This is the heart of this story. It's still moving for us. And being good disciples, even if they've had sort of a rough patch in their day, they turn around and they go back to Jerusalem to share this exciting news, to say that those women maybe weren't as crazy as they sounded. But everything that happens after communion isn't sort of the point where the story turns. The story turns when they come to the point where they want to stop for the night, and this stranger they are with is willing to keep going, and they ask him to stay. What if they hadn't? What if they had let the stranger keep walking? What if they had chosen to be alone with each other and their grief over Jesus who had died? What if they